to order the October 2012 meeting of the Devil's Lake Water Improvement District. First order of business is a special order of business informal presentation by Randy Trox.
Can I just give a quick introduction to that?
Sure.
Randy Trox was able to come today. He's the program coordinator for the on-site program through DEQ. And as you guys have been aware, I think since about 2009, they've been going through this rulemaking process to make some changes to the rules regarding the on-site wastewater systems, which we refer to as septic systems. This is what we were talking about, like policy option package 120 a couple years ago. There's a Senate Bill 83 we talked about quite a bit. And after the legislation then approved that most of the policy option package 120, then it was up to Randy and DEQ staff to draft the actual rules that were going to be regarding that program. So they've come up with a draft of those rules, some proposed rules, and the public comment for that is open right now. So Randy's doing a little tour, going around, kind of presenting what those rules are a little bit. There'll be some public hearings next week. Is that correct? Next week there'll be some public hearings. But Randy had a meeting in Tillamook tonight or earlier today and was able to coordinate to come tonight to just kind of explain what some of those new rules are going to be. So that's my intro. And thanks, Randy, for coming tonight.
Right. Okay. Am I sitting in the right place and everything?
Yeah, and just speak right into the mic so okay. That it picks up on the television and to the audience.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for having me. I'm Randy Trox with the DEQ. I work in the on-site program in Eugene. I'm the on-site program coordinator. And as Seth said, we're in a rulemaking period right now. And I was glad that we were able to work it out where I could double up a couple of meetings in one day. And it's 10, 11, 12. I just felt like I needed to share that today. So where are we in the rulemaking? It started pretty much the beginning of October, and it ends next Friday at 5 p.m., October 19th. You can provide comments by fax, email, and old-fashioned snail mail. We have public hearings next week, Medford on Tuesday, Eugene on Wednesday, and Portland on Thursday. And after we get all the comments, we consider the comments. I imagine there's going to be some changes to the draft that you're going to see today. And we're going to present this to the Environmental Quality Commission on December 6th for their consideration to adopt the rule. And we're proposing to have the implementation date of the rulemaking on March 1st of 2013. And there's more to the rule than what I'm going to present tonight. I'm just going to share with you the time of transfer, septic inspection stuff. There's some other stuff that's in the rulemaking, and that's the public hearings are sort of covering a more general geographic area, because there is some other stuff besides that. So the time of transfer septic inspection, it's in two sections. We have section 131 is the general, what is an inspection, a time of transfer septic inspection. The geographic rules are found in section 400 of our rules, and that's where the coastal zone piece of it and the reporting and the mandatory inspection part of this rule resides. And I'll walk through it piece by piece. This is a picture here of a sewer pipe from a mobile home park that somebody bootlegged in when they were having some problems with their septic system, and this was low tide. And not all failing systems are this easy to spot. It usually hides in the blackberries and things like that. You can't always see it, but there's bacteria in sewage, and it's not good to have it discharging into lakes and rivers and that sort of thing. So first up is who can do these inspections. We're proposing that it be a professional engineer with some septic system knowledge or environmental health specialist with septic system knowledge. NAWT is National Association of Waste Transporters. They have an inspector training certification program that does a really good overview of doing existing system inspections, and they have an ongoing certification program where the inspectors are required to get continuing education. And certified maintenance provider is something that we added in our 2005 rules to maintain our more advanced systems. So they're pretty familiar with how to check system components. And if you have questions, feel free to interrupt. So the first part is to collect records of what you have on the system, your permitting records, when it was installed, if there's any pumping records, any maintenance records for the that the seller may have. Field evaluation, they're gonna locate the system, obviously. Pump the tank is in the rule right now. I'm not sure if it's going to stay in the rule, but that's a requirement right now, is that they pump the septic tank and inspect the inside of the septic tank to assure the integrity of the system. And finally, expose the system components, like if it's a sand filter or a more technical, complex system, you're going to have more parts of it exposed just to make sure it's working adequately. And like a distribution box. A quick little anecdote is my boss put in a system in the late 80s at his house that he had built. And what happened was there's a Fernco coupler that attaches to the outside of the septic tank, and it separated before the thing ever got plugged in and worked. And like 10 years after it worked, the system started backing up, and he discovered that his drain field had never got any sewage at all, and it was just ponding outside his house around the septic tank until it got all plugged up and backed up into the house. So that's the what an inspection is required, and that would be like a general statewide requirement. Right now, we don't really have what a septic system inspection is. So if you sell your property and you have a septic inspection, some might be just a pumper pumping the tank, and that's it. Doesn't look at the drain field at all, or if there's sewage ponding anywhere. And if tank looks okay, it's a clean bill of health. I've heard of other inspections where they fill up the bathtub, they fill up all the sinks, they turn everything on full blast, and they put 1,000 gallons into the septic system that's designed to handle maybe 300 or 400 gallons a day. So it's just to standardize what an inspection would look like. So the coastal zone is, I don't know if you can see that okay, but the red line on this map is where we're proposing to implement this rule. The blue line is the Oregon Coastal Non-Point Pollution Control Program boundary, and it's a federally recognized boundary. And that boundary kind of dances between county lines, and it looked like a nightmare to implement whether you're in the zone or out of the zone. So we asked EPA if we could do countywide program instead of following the literal boundary, and they were okay with that as long as we got 90 or more percent of the population. The bottom right squiggly line, it should be all of Jackson County. This map is not totally accurate. So in the coastal zone, this is going to be a mandatory inspection and reporting process where the seller, it's going to collect those records. They're going to provide the buyer with those septic records. The evaluation is done, as I described, and then a report is submitted to DEQ. If the report is complete, then we will issue a certificate of completed inspection, and everything's kosher. If it's not complete, then we're going to have to go back and forth with the inspector to make sure that we get a completed inspection. And a complete inspection is to make sure that they checked everything and everything is accurately described of what they see. So we could have a situation where they find a failure and their report is going to document that it's a failure. And we're going to give a certificate of completed inspection, but it's going to be flagged in our system that we need to follow up with this property to make sure that they get it fixed. So why are we doing this now? Well, there was a federal lawsuit filed that involved Oregon. Oregon was not in compliance with the acronym is CESARA, its Coastal Zone Act reauthorization amendments of 1990, where there was three things that were identified that were Oregon was not in compliance with, and one of them was a septic inspection program for existing systems. The other two, it was a forestry issue that we're working on, and I think urban stormwater. So we are in a consent decree with EPA to complete this rulemaking by March of 2013, and the failure to comply with this coastal zone requirement is a loss of federal money that we pass along to groups that do things like riparian restoration, riparian fencing to keep cows out of the water, doing some helping communities upgrade their stormwater management plans and things like that. And states with statewide time of transfer inspections, I just figured I'd share that we're not the first state out of the box that's trying to do this. These are states that do statewide programs. Many states, like Washington, has the 12 Puget Sound counties. They all have time of transfer requirements. And then there's local jurisdictions here and there around that have similar requirements to what we're proposing. And do time of transfer inspections work? This is just an example that I found. The Barry Eaton District Health Department in Michigan implemented a time of sailor transfer program of their drinking water wells and septic systems in 2007, and then they did a three-year look back of how is it going. And what they found was 26% of the systems that were inspected were shown to be in failure, either repair or replacement. And they had a quote in there that the time of sailor transfer program has served as the single most effective tool in identifying and correcting public health environmental hazards that they have implemented. And I think they inspected over 2,000 septic systems with 26% failing, and they came up with how many gallons per year, and it was several million gallons a year of sewage that they were able to get out of the surface water by implementing this program. And there was another county in Michigan that said 18% systems were inspected. I talked to the Iowa on-site state guy, and he told me that their permit applications went up 30% when they implemented the program. But that was, you know, not an accurate correlation between the program. You know, they didn't draw a line that said from here to here. This is what happened. It could be a bump up, but it's still, there's a large percentage of that would be associated with failing systems. So, yeah, there's a web link on there that has the PowerPoint that has some pretty impressive pictures of failing systems that they found and corrected. And that's pretty much what I have.
So I think at this point we'll just open it to questions if you're okay with that, Mr. Scriven.
Sure. I guess my first question is, you know, what do you expect to define as a failure of a system? I mean, what would be some indicators you'd expect to be looking for in terms of the inspection against?
Well, our definition of failure is surfacing on the ground surface or discharging into public waters. And public waters includes groundwater, which is pretty hard to, you'd have to uncover and figure out where the water table is and where the drain field is, but it's public waters.
So holes in a tank would be discharging into public waters then? Or?
Well, that would be, or with Seth, I think. It was a public health hazard, I think. Okay. Now, I got the my rule book right here. I can just look it up because I know I have the answer here. So it's directly or indirectly onto the ground surface or under public waters or that create a public health hazard. So if you have a tank that is not completely enclosed, if it's a rotten steel tank, for example, that's a public health hazard. Somebody could fall into that tank people have fallen on those tanks, and it's a public health hazard.
Thanks.
I'm wondering if you've identified a methodology for testing drain fields. Is there any specified methodology we'd use, or just whatever?
To make sure a drain field is not failing?
Yes.
Well, that's where we were hoping, and I'm not sure if what the final rules are going to look like, but our draft proposed rules we have exposing system components, and if you open up, your system has a distribution box, which most do, you can look at, is it backing up, is it draining, is there evidence that it's been backed up for a long time, there's signs you can see from looking at the distribution box on whether the liquid level has been way above the holes in the distribution box that distribute it to the drain field. Sometimes you see a lot of roots are packed in there. There's a lot you can see by looking at a distribution box. Now, if it's an old system with no records, we're expecting that they're going to have to figure out where it goes, because if you don't know where it is, it makes it really hard to inspect it to make sure that it's working okay. But, you know, primarily is sewage getting into the drain field, and is the drain field accepting it? It's not a perfect system, because if a house has been vacant for a long time, then it may have slowly percolated down, but you still could be having some problems with your system, that when somebody moves in with three kids or four kids or something like that, that suddenly you're overwhelming the system and it's having problems, or it's discharging out on the surface. So it's not a perfect system, but it's better than no system.
Thank you.
Might I ask a question here? Randy, you mentioned that there was part of the proposal that you didn't expect, or you didn't know would move forward, and that was the pumping. Can you explain some of the pros and cons of pumping tank?
Well, the pros of pumping a septic tank is that you can see what is the condition of the tank is in. I talked to a number of pumpers that said that they've seen a bunch of tanks that look fine, but when they pump them, the side of the wall of the tank is blown out, or there was a rock when they set the tank and just popped a hole in the bottom of the tank. There's cracks that can form in the tank, which in the wintertime you can have groundwater coming in, and in the summer you're going to have groundwater coming out. The con to mandatory tank pumping that I've heard from some realtors is, one, the cost. It's like Tillamook, they were telling me it's about $400 to pump a tank, and I know in other parts it's $300, $250. You know, it varies depending on where you are, but that's a significant cost to a homeowner in a time where there's not a lot of equity in their home. And it was also pointed out that lenders would they want to see that the tank has been pumped within 6 months of closing. So if somebody wanted to be proactive and pump their tank before they listed their house, had their system inspected, submitted a report, to us it's good for 2 years, that report. To a lender, they're saying, well, it's been 6 months, it's been 8 months, you need to pump the tank again before you move. So someone has to pay another $300, $400 before they can close on their house. And so that's going to be an economic burden. So we could make that instead of a, and I'm not saying we're taking it out, but if we did take it out, we could just make it a recommended practice and try to do some educational materials instead of making it a mandatory rule that they do that.
Does this happen each and every time a transfer of a house occurs? If a house sells three times in a 10-year period, you do it three times?
That's what we're proposing, yeah. We're, you know, one of the things we can consider that's a variable is how long is one of these good for. In our draft rules, we have 2 years. It could be that we consider saying it's valid for more than 2 years.
Yeah, I didn't understand. You said within 6 months of the transfer, right? It would have to be done.
Well, that's what I'm told that lenders require.
Okay, I don't understand that. What good does it do a lender to know whether or not it's working if they've already transferred the house and already made the loan.
I'm not sure why the lenders require tank pumping. Maybe it's new home, new poop. I don't know what the selling point of that is, but for some reason they... there's no question when I talk to the realtors that I have talked to that it's 6 months. If it's longer than 6 months, they say it's no good. Got to pump it again, and I don't know why.
No, but they're requiring it before the sale closes.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the part I didn't understand.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. Yes.
Okay. All right, and then finally, if you find a system to be a failure, is there, okay, you mentioned that then you keep on them to rectify it, but are there any teeth in that? Do they really have to rectify it? Can they just hold off until they sell it 5 years later?
Well, it's our intent that we're going to get it fixed, that we're going to have a staff person in place that would pursue enforcement if it came to that, but that's usually a last resort to try to encourage folks to get it fixed. The intent is when you do the inspection that the buyer is going to discover there's a problem with the septic system, and then it's going to be a negotiated part of the sale.
Mm. Yeah.
That's my expectation.
Good expectation.
When you state transfer, time of transfer, does that... if you have some property handed down and there's actually no sale, is there a requirement there, or how does that work?
Yes, it's a time of transfer, so if there is a property that changes hands, then they are required to comply with that rule.
Randy, what percentages of the properties are selling every year, do you guys know?
That are on septic systems?
Or? It wouldn't have to be septic system specifics. I'm assuming it would, you know, apply all. But to my knowledge, I think people transfer property about once every 5 years. So if that were the formula, in about, you know, 20 years, you'd have them all just by... this, but do you guys have a formula? You got a problem you're trying to solve, and this is taking a piece out of it.
Yeah, it's not the end all be all, and my understanding is that rural property doesn't change hands as often as a more urban parcel does. But we haven't calculated what we think the turnover would be until we got all of the systems. This is one of the methods that we looked at as an option. We looked at some other options, and we've talked to the Paul and Seth about some of the other possibilities. The advisory committee that we had recommended mandatory maintenance of all septic systems on a periodic basis, and that would require a lot more staffing than we have. It would be a pretty robust program, and it would be not one that's going to be an easy sell to the community. And I know Florida, for example, they had Senate Bill 550 that they were proposing that rule. And new governor, new election, and it's all gone. It's dead. It's not going to happen. Dune City, they proposed that, and that changed. There was maybe some changes on their city council, and that mandatory inspection program went away. It's a tough program to sell unless you can make that clear connection. And I'm hoping that with this program that at least we can make a start, that by submitting a report to DEQ that we're going to be able to track how many are failing out there. What are we seeing? And is this something that needs more attention to improve water quality?
Randy, one of the questions that we've had when we've been pursuing our program is who at the end of the day determines that the system is failing. So one of the things we've talked about doing is having a private inspector go out and do the inspection. As you're moving forward with this, have you guys addressed that at all? Would it be the private inspector who makes the determination of the failure, or is it something through DEQ or a different state agency?
I can't say that we've... Making the determination is a tricky phrasing, because there are some, like the health licensing, for example, an environmental health specialist is qualified to make a determination, but maybe a certified maintenance provider isn't qualified by law to make that determination. So what we're thinking is that they make observations of what they see. Do they see sewage on the ground? And they're documenting they're seeing sewage on the ground. We're going to say that that's a failure when we get that and look at that report. So that might be a little game of semantics there of who actually saw the failure, but it's the determination is probably going to be made by DEQ, by how the form is filled out. What are they observing?
Thanks.
So I was curious, you talked about the loss of federal funds, 319. Do you know what amount of funds that is? Is it a substantial amount of money? That
I think it's, I'm pretty sure currently it's about $1 million per year that is distributed.
One other question, you know, kind of stepping back to you, if you end up not doing, you know, the pump at time of inspection, would you be considering other alternatives to regulating the reporting requirements if you know, contractors out there pumping a tank identify something that would qualify as a failing tank, to, you know, push that forward in terms of, we have a, you know, I've noticed a system that would need to be, you know, addressed, or is that outside the scope of what you're looking at if you don't get a pumping, you know, portion on your inspections?
I'm not sure I'm following the question.
So if you're unable to, you know, if the pumping part gets pulled out of your inspection criteria, mm-hmm. and pumping is going on at other times during the life cycle of the system, right, it's an opportunity to make observations of whether or not the tank is intact and in good shape. Are you going to be putting any rules within this zone to where if a service provider notices things that would be needing to be addressed, that is forwarded onto DEQ or reported up?
Well, you know, I think I need to stick with what the rule says right now. The draft rule says right now that pumping is mandatory. Mm-hmm. You're welcome to submit comments that if you have concerns that if that were removed, what would that mean? Or if you think that's an important component of the rule, that would be good to know. Because I think there is value to it. That's why we put it in there. But looking at the whole Spectre, I can see where it could be a burden for some folks, and if it's already being implemented another way, then maybe we could find a way to work it in together that
sure.
It needs to be submitted if it is pumped.
Randy, one more question. In the materials we were given before the meeting, it says that pressurized distribution systems will have to have a maintenance agreement along with advanced treatment.
Yes.
Septic systems.
Yes.
Does pressurized distribution systems, that include the small line pressurized sewer systems that are coming into vogue, and that we're actually trying to do an LID that features?
No. Okay. No, it's pressure distribution is. I had a false ending there because this is used for other stuff, but I have some pictures in here that of a sand filter. Right there is a sand filter, which it's not a pressurized distribution, but it uses a pressure manifold. It's a similar design. This is just one of these pressure manifold pipes, these pressure laterals with the holes in a trench, a rock and pipe trench or a chamber trench. Is a pressure distribution system. So it has 5 feet of squirt, And the reason we're requiring that is that those are typically sited on sandy soils, and the reason they put it on sandy soils is because if you don't, gravity systems, it just goes right down into the aquifer. So they pressurize it so it's distributed equally over a whole sand lens, so you're not having a point loading discharge and you get more opportunity for plants to take up the nutrients. But only if it's maintained. If you don't maintain it, those pressure laterals, it pretty much gets like packed in with, it looks like a sausage when it comes out when you clean them out if you haven't done it in a while, because solids under pressure just get packed at the end of the line, and over time it starts clogging each one of these lines that you see. So starting at the end and moving towards the head. So then you pretty much have a the same thing as a gravity system if you don't maintain it. So all sand filters and pressure distribution systems we're proposing get maintenance contracts and submit annual reports demonstrating that they're being maintained.
Thank you.
Any additional questions? Well, appreciate your time, Randy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kelly.
Cool. Thank you, Randy. Is it okay if I just continue with my septic staff report and we do this all as one?
Do we have to do the consent agenda first before we dive into that? Okay. That's fine. Go ahead, Seth.
I guess the last thing is that part of this process then is that we are in a public comment period, so I think it's very important for us to make a public comment on that. So in your staff report, I put a couple of suggestions, kind of an outline of what our public comment could be, and I think the best way for us to do is just to draft a letter. And we haven't really talked about it in detail, but perhaps attend a public hearing and, you know, give an outline of what we're saying in our letter, an oral presentation as well. But as far as what I think it's really important for us to state in that public comment, for one, it's just simply that we support this proposal for the most part. It's been something that we've been supporting since it was a policy option package. So just stating our support for the program. And in that, including the information that we have about our watershed, the septic inventory that we've produced, the strides that we've been making to assure that septic systems are functioning in our watershed. One, I think, really key thing that we need to state in this is that I see us having our local program that's having inspections for septic systems in the watershed. And then in addition, there's going to be this state program as well. And I think what's really important for us to do is to make those two programs blend together as best as possible so people who live in the watershed aren't doing two different programs. Randy and I have had the opportunity to talk about this a little bit. So when we create our inspection form, ideally it would be pretty much the same thing that DEQ produces for their inspection form. So if our program moves forward, as we've decided, where you have to have your system inspected every 10 years, you could take that form, you'd submit it regularly to us. If then you were going to sell your property and you had to go to the state, you could take that form and say, here, we've already done this for our local program, and it would also count towards the state's program. Additionally, on the other side of it, if you're selling your house and you have an inspection form, you could submit that to the city and to the local DEQ here, and then that would be good, and you'd be put on the back of that list of the 10-year program. So what we've been proposing is that every 10 years you'd have an inspection, and then any time within that 10 years, when you go to have your system inspected, the idea is that you would just go use that inspection form, submit it in advance, and at the end of the day, then no one would actually ever be told to have an inspection. They would just be continually rolling through. Was that totally clear, that idea?
Yeah, I think so. I think the only challenge in there is the line that you draw between who makes the determination. Where does it, are you determining whether it's going to be failing? Is the district, or is it the state, or is it the county? Right on that level. So
well, at that level, the county is the state. So, that form. I think what Randy was saying makes a lot of sense. That you would have an inspector go out who would make the observations. But at the end of the day, it's DEQ who makes the determination if it's failing or not, based on the observations that the inspector makes. Then I think simply supporting the maintenance agreements for sand filters is important. Continuing to support a subsurface. This is one thing here. When this went before the legislature, there was an idea of creating a subsurface loan program. So there'd be money available, like a revolving loan program, that if your system fails, you go to the state and get low-interest loans to do improvements. And that's something that didn't pass the legislature, but I think it's important that that idea stays alive, so I thought that we should include that in a letter that we have. And those are really the points that I've outlined. If you guys have additional points that you might like to make in that letter or to scrap some of it, I think we can discuss that now.
Well, you know, another question for Randy occurs to me. Now, do you have any other data besides that? I don't know if that's one county. Well, you mentioned a couple of others. One that the one you mentioned first said 26% of the systems that were inspected were failing. You said another body that had reported said 18% were failing. My point is, I don't think anybody's really excited about having to have this inspection every time you transfer a piece of property. But, I mean, if it's that effective, then it sounds like it might be a good idea. It would be more convincing if you had more data than just a couple of counties across the country. So is there any more evidence of that, that how frequent the failings are?
Well, Eugene Water and Electric Board did a study. They got a 319 grant, which is this money that's federal government would be required to withhold from Oregon if we didn't comply. They got a 319 grant to look at septic system impacts on the McKenzie River that provides water for Eugene. And so they did free pump outs, free inspection program with this loan money, and they ponied up a bunch of their own money to do the same inspection. And their findings were consistent with what we talked about today, with the number of either failing systems. I think they saw, like, I don't have the number off the top of my head, but it's in my head, it's 14-16% somewhere in there were failing, needing replacement, and then they had other systems that were needing some other work that was pretty significant. It wasn't operating correctly, but it wasn't maybe a failure. So I think there's some pretty good information, and systems don't last forever. A lot of the housing stock is getting pretty old, and if you think DEQ's had a statewide program since 1974, and if there's unpermitted systems out there, that means it's older. It's approaching 40 years old or more, some of these systems, and they don't last forever.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Well, so, I mean, if you have, I mean, 14% of how many systems we have around the lake, you got 14% of those things failing. You know, that's a lot of nutrient loading in the Devil's Lake. So it's pretty hard for us, wearing our board director hats, to not support that.
And just as a comment to that, 1974 point of when the inspections or permits were supposed to began, it was like 1 in 3 of our systems don't have any record, and that's some 680 systems in the watershed. So a third of all systems in Devil's Lake watershed are pre-1974 that have no record of installation. So, you know, if septic systems do not last forever, as I think we all can agree and know, then those are 38 years plus already. So getting those inspected would be a good thing for Devil's Lake and for the homeowner too. You know, this goes back to some points that we've made, I think, in discussions about you know, having an inspection means you can get ahead of a problem before it, you know, comes into your basement, kind of thing. You know, I mean, there's some real value to having a functioning septic system besides, you know, public safety and water quality.
And I think even when we, more to that point, when we looked at the systems over 30 years old, so you had those one-third of systems that we don't know how old they are, pre-1974, it's assumed. Then you add the systems that are just over, I believe it was 30 years old, and we're at half. Those are half the systems in our watershed are likely have exceeded their limits. And I think the one other point to make is, you know, the state has come up with this program because they're required, in order to keep this 319 funding from EPA, they're required to have, to show that they are managing septic systems, which I think is a really good first step. But the thing is that this isn't able to this isn't able to prioritize them based on any information on the system. So the systems that are going to be reviewed through this program, it's simply time of sale. So you might have a home that could have three of these inspections in 5 years, or I guess the maximum could be 6 years because it would be 2 years in between. But there could be homes that go 80 years that are never inspected. So I think what we have in our watershed is we're looking at a local solution to this. And we actually have information on the systems. We know how old they are. We know how much water they're using every month. We know where they are in the landscape. And we know the last time that DEQ approved the system. And we know that half of those systems have most likely exceeded what is a reasonable limit on it. So I think it's really important that we don't look to this program as a way to replace what we're doing. I think these two programs work really well together. And, you know, if our goal is to be doing nutrient reduction, I think the program that we've outlined is a really, we've prioritized ourselves to really focus on those systems first.
So I am, I'm in agreement that we can do a letter of support, and I think that you know, the points that you made are fine and valid for what we would be looking at wanting to support. I don't know. Does anybody have any issue with doing that?
Mr. Chair, you might just look to see if the audience has any points on this matter and take public comment regarding that. If you like, I think that would be a good
Would any public members like to post comment on the... All right, okay. So so I guess I'll make a motion that we draft a letter of support, that Seth and I draft a letter of support for the program.
With the points that Seth mentioned?
Points that Seth had gone through and that are in the staff report, so...
I'll second that motion.
Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, motion carries unanimously. Thanks, Seth. Thanks, Randy. Okay, so let's move up and cover the consent agenda. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes and the financial report?
I'll make a motion to approve the consent agenda.
Second.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. Since agenda passes, let's go on to public comment. Larry Rich.
Larry Rich, 4590 Northeast Loop Drive. Mark Christie asked me to read this letter to the board tonight, so I'm going to do. It says, I regret that I am unable to attend tonight's meeting due to a business conflict. I do want to weigh in for the official public record of this month's meeting on inaccurate statements made by Brian Green in last month's board comments and announcement sections as it relates to comments made by Larry Rich in the public comment section of the September meeting. Larry clearly asked about the vote that was taken by the board in June to lower the lake level, not remove the dam, as Brian stated in his comments. The board did vote and take official board action to establish the impoundment level of the lake at 9.0. Furthermore, there are numerous references by Brian in the June meeting minutes that would give the impression that complete dam removal could be a possibility at some point in the future, which contradicts his statement in September that says there is no plan to remove the dam. Brian is correct that there was no vote taken to give up the district's current water right to impound up to 9.53. However, at the end of the June 7th meeting, there was a serious discussion between Brian Green and Randy Weldon to instruct Paul to permanently and officially request a termination of our current water right of 9.53 to 9.0. In fact, Brian made an official board motion. Green moved to request the WRD to reduce the impoundment right by an amount of water sufficient to keep the lake level at a maximum height of 9.0 feet. Mitchell Moore was able to diffuse the motion by correctly stating the facts of the current water right. This fact, by the way, should have been known and stated by Paul with any discussion around or concerning the DELWID water rights with the WRD. Gary Ellingson, Lincoln City Councilor, took me on a tour around Lincoln City and showed me firsthand how they have correctly spent millions of taxpayers' dollars securing water rights to protect the future livability and growth of Lincoln City and the surrounding county. Some of you within minutes would have thrown that right away without even knowing what you were doing. You wonder why we have trust issues. Mark Christie. Said one other thing I wanted to mention. My wife and I were out kayaking last Tuesday at the canals near Dee River, and we ran into Robert Nichols, who was working on his boat. He told us that he had replaced his prop after hitting a submerged log, and he was currently installing an electric motor so he can get his boat out into the lake. We asked him to come to the water board meeting tonight, and he said that he gets easily upset and that he has a heart condition, so we told him that it was probably a good idea that he did not attend.
Thank you, Larry. Mitch Moore?
PowerPoint, so brought one for you.
Do I get one, Mitch? I can read it to you.
Hello, guys. Sorry I missed the September meeting. I was out of town. It was kind of difficult to get caught up this month. The minutes just came out Friday, and Channel 4 was running the August meeting. I finally kind of figured that out. I called the city, and they quickly rectified it last week. But you might consider maybe dual running the September and the October meetings for a while, because September's only been out there for a very short time since the last meeting. I'm here tonight to discuss the presentation that was made last month, or at least it's based to some degree on the presentation made last month on the condition of the lake. And I'm going to suggest that different viewpoints might come to different conclusions. And again, this is kind of just to everybody on the board and nobody personally. It's just kind of observations from the lake during the year. I've been asked by many to share their general observations through the summer. So they did I guess to review, kind of talking about what I think is the impact of the lake level decision last year on its impact on the algae bloom, on shoreline, on navigation, on lake temp, and on public opinion. It seems prudent to do that now at the end of the season. Then it's out of the way, so when we go through this again next year, get to that point in the time, we maybe want to reach all of this. So I provide you all a packet tonight to support my comments. People watching this meeting on Charter Channel 4 and wishing to follow along can download the material from elakeoregon.com in the quick links area or from the Devil's Lake Navigator Facebook page. According to the district's data, our algae bloom began this year in the second half of July with scum floating to the surface the first week of August. Since then, the lake's been an absolute mess. The first four images found on pages 1 and 2 represent scenes you could see on any given morning on Devil's Lake this summer. Visible algae under the lake surface plus giant patches of scum where algae cells were so numerous they completely obscured the water below the surface. The next eight images on pages 4 through 7 illustrate how September and October lake levels have placed our shoreline in jeopardy. According to the erosion study, 16% of the shoreline shows signs of erosion. That's 12% on unarmored shoreline and 4% on armored shoreline. Or 84% of the lakeshore showed no sign of erosion. The study says 70% of our shoreline is armored. The vast majority of the shoreline armoring is constructed from foundations that sit at about 9 feet, plus or minus a few inches. These pictures show the vulnerability that 8.8 lake level creates on the exposed armored foundations, previously not in jeopardy. This erosion is repeated all over the lake. These pictures didn't happen this way just in 1 year, but normal summertime wind and boat waves have less of an impact when these foundations are covered by water, and this situation certainly got worse during this last summer. On page 8, we see the dock constructor 2 summers ago by Bill Sexton, or my neighbor, Gallen. Doug came before you last year indicating that he had been severely impacted by the board's decision to delay impoundment. This summer, he had 6 inches of water at the transom of his boat. He's finally managed to get his boat out of the lake, but he went out to pull his boat out. It could no longer be used. It was sitting on the lake bottom. This occurred even though he went, at the beginning of the season, dredged as big of a hole as he could with his prop, but he still had a boat stuck on the bottom of the lake. It's finally out. Not been able to dock my boat since mid-August when the level dipped below 9.0 as I can no longer approach my dock. To me, that they have not been able to remove their boat from their boat lift due to low water. I just received an email while this meeting was going of another person who does not know how to get his boat out of the water this winter because it's stuck on a boat lift that will not let water. A board member once said, where is the personal responsibility, implying we should all quit complaining, pony up, and fix our problem. But I'd like to ask, where's the public responsibility? It makes sense that the body caused tens of thousands of dollars of private expenditure. But does it make sense that the lake has to endure the shock of construction and repair of permitted impoundment structures all over the lake? Much has been said in these meetings of predatory bass lurking in dark places. Does it really make sense for people to take personal responsibility, doubling the length of their docks, as been suggested, and doubling the places for these fish to hide? Is that really what's best for them? One public comment that was made to me directly is, I'll read, we have been on the lake for over 40 years and never seen it in this bad a shape. We've had our house on the market all summer, and now it has come to our attention that buyers are not interested in mudfront property because of the lake level. We are now considering a lawsuit for damages. And it continues. There's only 3 of us here tonight. On page 9, I've copied the material from the last month's board meeting. You can see we had a consistent, considerable, and continuing bloom this summer. Data presented last month shows blooms in 2008, 9, and 12. The pie charts I added show the percentage of samples with scum present in red. All agree 2011 was a great year, with just 19% of the samples showing algae. 2010 was omitted from the chart provided last month, but according to staff reports, we saw no bloom in that year. Page 10 shows another chart from last year or last month's presentation. 2008 and 2009 show temps above the 70-degree mark. 2010 and 11, the years without algae, fell below 68 degrees. 12, a year with a massive bloom, saw a rise in temperature. Indeed, on average, 2012 temperatures are 3% higher than 2011. Data has not been posted beyond August, and it appears that the final sample drops, the drop in temperature is in accordance with a one-day very strong rainstorm in August, that, and temperatures would likely rise after that cold water mixed in the column. Page 11 addresses the question, did weather patterns cause this shift? Specifically the weather that occurred in Lincoln City. For comparison's sake, let's establish 2011, where lake temperatures were below 68 degrees and we had no bloom as a baseline. Take a look at 2008 comparison, and it indicates 53% of the days during impoundment were warmer than in 2011. 54% of those days were characterized as clear, similarly in 2011. The lake skews in the expected direction and is warmer in 2011. On page 12, we continue the analysis for 2009 and 10. Here we see that 78% of the days in 2009 were hotter than in 11. Again, the lake temperatures responded by moving in the same direction. In 2010, the lake spent equal time above and below this year, the year that followed, and the lake responded with levels that were pretty similar, remaining below 68 degrees. Page 13 illustrates our lake at a lower level. Admittedly, the conclusions drawn on the previous pages are overly simplified. We know there are many factors at work related to lake temperature. However, there was a general trend that seems to indicate average air temperatures do have an impact on lake temperatures. Now let's look at 2012. While all would agree it was a nice summer, our temperatures were higher than last year by only 36%. In other words, they were lower by 64% of the time. Yet unlike any other years illustrated, our lake temperature went the opposite direction, increasing 3%. So in summary, the discussion at last month's meeting suggested the board lake level decision had no negative impact on the lake. There have been many negative impacts on the lake. It was due to low lake levels this summer. The data suggests lower lake level does lead to higher water temperatures. The behavior of the lake seems to correlate with these changes in temperatures where algae blooms in years above 68 degrees do not occur. The board decision to lower the lake clearly has done little or nothing positive for Devil's Lake, but it seems to have done some negatives. Another view, just because I'm always the one here, is provided by Jack Strayer, who thinks Devil's Lake Navigator is much too kind, and he says there should be little surprise that we have higher water temperature, lower lake levels, mudfront property, and scum so thick you can cut it with a knife. He says his family was unable to use their property for children swimming or use their boat lift since the start of August. So I just want to summarize this. I hear from property owners all over the lake and users. I go to the boat ramp and talk to people, and everybody's kind of wondering what happened this year. We don't know that everything I said here is true, but there does seem to be a trend, and hopefully it's just something to ponder between now and next May when we take another look at this. So thank you for the time to write that.
Your comments, Mitch.
Mr. Chair, can I?
Yes, go ahead.
You know, I've been hearing exactly the opposite, and I'm not out fishing for comments. They find me. that's one of the things about being here. And I do find it curious that this is the largest drought we've had in history. And so if there is differences, I would be more inclined to question a drought that we never had for, 1,000 years?
We had just 3.55 inches, twice the rain.
I just want to take a time.
Okay.
All right. So I was hoping maybe, Paul, you could comment on that.
Well, it's been an exceedingly dry period since July, and we had an extremely wet June. So, you know, there's a couple kind of interesting things at play. You know, with a lot of water, you get a lot of nutrients can come into a lake system, and that can certainly impact blue-green algae production. The drier air temperature, or the drier weather, and higher potential evening air temperatures, I think can have a considerable amount of capacity for that water to stay warm. You know, when you have clear nights, the fog doesn't come in and hold that heat back in the lake, it can stay warmer too. So, yeah, you know, weather is very variable, as we know, and I think that long term you can start making some predictions, but you know, I know that the first that I saw some information relative to this from the public commenter was taking 2 years of data. I'm glad to see that he's at least looking at additional data, because it's imperative that things aren't left to 1 to 2 years. You know, when we talked about this impoundment right, I said very clearly that water quality is going to be the very most difficult one to answer relative to this. You know, that was going to be very much hard to call. There's nothing definitive about it. And cyanobacteria, blue-green algae, are very much unpredictable. So, you know, if you're basing, you know, this just on their, you know, reaction, their reactions are not 100% consistent with what you might expect. Warmer water plays a role. Additional sunlight plays a role. But it's not, there's no direct correlation between the amount of windless days you have. I mean, the science just isn't there. So I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Well, I think I understood that. But bottom line is, what you're saying is that the fact that we kept the lake level at 9, or we raised it to 9 feet, is that responsible for all the algae?
No. I mean, to say that any one thing is responsible for the algae would be to mischaracterize the way algae grows in the lake and reacts. You've got sunlight that is a very important condition of the growth of algae. You have nutrients that are very fundamental in the growth of algae, cyanobacteria. So to say that the lake level, impounding lake level to 9 feet, is the cause for cyanobacteria, blue-green algae, would actually fly in the face to what we saw from 2009, because we actually saw more water in 2009 held back and really significant blooms. So
we actually had higher water temperatures than 9.
Yep. And we did, yeah. So, you know, that's kind of the points that we tried to make last time. And, it's 5-year trend is what we were looking at, because that's a fair amount of data. 2-year trends are really not a trend. That's just, there's no trend between 2 years. It's just one or the other's comparison. The water quality of Devil's Lake has a lot of impacts. And one of the impacts that we talked about raising the lake level, I think, it's kind of echoed in the first half of tonight's meeting about septic systems. You know, we have failed septic systems out there in the watershed. If we had to guess, you know, maybe 14%, maybe 24%, some kind of range that are probably failed, just based on what, you know, EWEB did and others did around the nation. Nutrients that come through those systems, those failed systems in particular, are going to move more readily when the lake level's higher, because that's raising the water table. And so creating a system that brings nutrients to your lake during the peak time where you have sunlight coming in is going to favor the production of blue-green algae. I mean, it really is. You know, there's a lot of components that have gone into your decision, and the shoreline issues were fundamental. You know, what we see is additional growth, vegetative growth, as a result of reducing not impounding as much water. You know, if somebody wants to look at the Dee River, it's a really simple one. You can just go stand on the bridge, and you can see where the lake level was basically last year, because the vegetation line is basically demarked by where it grew when the lake was 9.5 and where it grew to when it was 9.0 beginning this summer. So growing vegetation on the shoreline is a benefit to Devil's Lake. And so that was part of the discussions that you had and other things. So, like I said, back in those hearings and again reiterating tonight, the water quality issue was the one with the biggest question mark on both sides.
And just as a, did you get a copy of this?
Yes, I did. I got to review it.
Can
just
you
while
characterize
you
for me the difference in, you know, how something is, you know, how a you know, like a seawall can be in jeopardy when water's not touching the base of it, or when water's not up against it?
Well,
I mean, if you have a shoreline in front of a seawall, how is that wall in jeopardy? I'm struggling.
Underfetting is what he... Yeah.
I mean, the waves come in, and when it's sitting at that level, it just all the little waves come in and hit there and basically pull all the material out from behind the wall. That's how the walls collapse from behind. It just migrates right out. You can go to a wall that has gravel behind it and find the gravel all out in front of the wall. It doesn't happen as often to the
page six extent. Shows no water against the wall.
When a boat pictures were taken in calm water to show you the level of the lake. And the other thing, you know, not to get into a debate here, but this got expanded into a whole septic and everything else. There's a couple simple points I was just trying to make, and only just to consider. I don't have answers here. I just want you guys to think about
it. Get a better understanding
between now and then. And the main one here is that when you look at the data that was presented last month, that kind of was to present it to say there was really no impact that was directly related to lake level. If you look at it kind of in a different way, you can look at the years that the lake was higher in temperature, and it was higher in level. In those years, compared, just as I could have used any year as a baseline, but in 2011, it was generally warmer in that year, and therefore the lake, even though it was higher, was warmer. And in the year that it was generally cooler than 2011 or equal to that, the lake was at the same level it was in 2008 and 9 and 10 and 11, and the lake went down in temperature because it was cooler outside. So for sure the biggest impact on lake temperature is the air temperature. However, last year it was cooler and the lake went up in temperature. That seems kind of odd. I'm not the scientist, and you guys just take that for what it is. It also happens that each of the years that we had algae bloom were the years that we got up to 70 degrees. Now, I don't know if there's a magic number between 70 and 68 or any of that. It just seems coincidentally odd. So I'm just pointing those out in the, and I'm not saying you guys voted and made the algae bloom. I'm simply saying these are some observations on the lake. And I don't go fishing for people's observations either. They come to me as well. People, I can't go anywhere on the lake without somebody hunting me down and telling me their opinion on the lake, trust me, or that they can't get their boat off their lift or this or that. That's just part of me also being at these meetings all the time. So, and also I just want to point out that 2011 actually was a wetter year than this last summer. It was 3.55 inches of rain in the summer of 2011 and 1.73 inches of rain this last summer. It seems drier, but it really wasn't. I can tell you the wettest day, it was the day that I took the whole front of my house off, and it rained like crazy that day, and it all came right in. But So I won't take any more of your time, but I'm not here for you guys to decide whether I'm right or he's right or whatever. I only ask that you ponder this data. It's just different data. You got data from Paul. This is data from me. Take it and sort of consider it. And that's it.
All right.
I'm not right.
Thanks.
I'm not wrong. So
I appreciate you taking the time to put that together. I'll look at it a little bit more detail, and if I have some questions, I'll reach out. Would you like to come up, Mr. Dooling?
Yeah.
Please do.
I'll be brief this time.
For the record, my name is Pat Dooling. We have a home at 4799 Northeast East Devils Lake Road. I'm here tonight to report to you about the conditions adjacent to our property, the north end of us, and around our own home and parts of many properties visible from East Devils Lake Road, since the lake level has been lowered. Also, there's a question. Why is the lake level being maintained at 8.8 when you passed a resolution to set the level at 9? In the past that we haven't been able to use our boathouse because we aren't able to use because we designed it for a 9.5-foot level. During that meeting, one board member commented, when the 9-foot vote was forthcoming, that homeowners needed to fix the problems themselves. He had no particular sympathy for people's plights and concerns. We have the resources to do just that and are doing so. But many people have no way out of these serious circumstances. To the north of us, in Horseshoe Bay, the two most northern properties have docks that are high and dry. One of those properties has 40 or 50 feet of mud in front of it. Both these properties are for sale, but who on earth would buy them? The docks adjacent to those properties on both sides, you can't get a boat up to them. As well as one down from that, Devil's Lake Road, which is adjacent to our house, but our house is on the lake, so we have more depth, although it's very shallow in front. During the meeting, the second meeting, one board member commented that he'd only been on the lake a couple of times in a boat. But I can tell you that you can easily drive up to the end of North Devil's Lake, the north end of Devil's Lake Road, and park in one of those properties that's for sale and walk out there and see all the mud. It's kind of astounding. And then on a hot day, I went back there today and I didn't smell, but last weekend it reeked. And we have about 6 feet of fresh mud in front of our place, and it smelled bad all summer. Now, I want to explain to you that our house is at the mouth of Horseshoe Bay. It's a very recent build. We have a sand filter, a very expensive system. It's a pretty good system. The house next to us was built by the same builder. It has a sand filter. All the properties then are vacant lots up there that I'm talking about where the docks are high and dry at the end. Then the properties over to the left that are also unusable are fairly modern. I would guess they're built in the last 10 years. Then there's one at the end that's a long timer. But we're not talking about any kind of failed septic systems in this area. And the stench is really bad. Additionally, there's exposed slimy mud, varying amounts. Okay, I addressed that. On view from East Devils Lake Road, there are scores of docks that are clearly too high to be used. You can see where if a boat came up to them, they'd bump into the posts. The rack is way to hell above it. So no one can safely, any age, use those things. And we're talking about a lot. If you just drive, you don't need to be on the water. Just drive around and look. No one wants our children swimming and walking in slimy muck in public parks and homes when it can be remedied by a carrying board.
Remedied by what?
Sorry?
Remedied by what, did you say?
A caring board.
No.
Would those problems be rectified by another 4 or 5 inches of water? Seriously?
Because well,
I mean,
4 or 5 inches is critical. That last two, when you went down to 8.8, really made a hell of a mess. But, you know, I'm no expert. But the water's dropped everywhere, big time. Now, 4 or 5, I'm not exactly sure, but it sure makes a huge difference.
Well, you say a caring board. Let me say this. I've always been for a higher level for my own reasons, but I understand why we did what we did. And I have to say the area you're talking about is a problematic area. I don't even think it's natural. I think it was dug out years ago.
It was dug out years ago, but it was,
I'm not
it was
sure
usable.
We can solve
it's been usable
problem.
Until this year.
Well, and I'm not sure why it would be that much more usable with a few more inches. I really
well,
don't.
You know what? We're going to have proof in the pudding because as soon as the water level gets back up to 953, we're going to see. It's that simple. Truly.
I'm just thinking that there might be a lot of
sedimentation. We're observing what it is now, and when it gets to 953, we're going to observe what it is there.
Okay.
It's kind of simplistic. And I bet you it's going to be, I know Horseshoe Bay will be full of water again. It always has been. Even though it's problematic, it's never been deep up there at the end because they didn't dig it that deep at the end. And, of course, it sloughs down. There's a little natural stream in there. And, it, by the way, it's still running, even though...
It's Nyatsu Creek that goes into there, isn't it?
Yeah, it was running this morning.
Mr. Dooley? Did I get your name right? Mr. Dooley, right?
Dooley, yeah.
First of all, I think you do have a carrying board. And but you ever noticed the dock out on the Sletz Bay 51st
yep.
Street?
I used to crab there.
Me too.
I heard your argument before, and I understand that. That's the ocean.
Well,
it's different from a lake.
Well, but the problem's the same in that you're having sediment.
We certainly have exacerbated the problem by removing a dam, clearly.
Well, if you can hear me out.
I will.
That problem's not going away. And as the bottom comes up, you know, you just can't possibly raise the water enough to compensate for it. And at least it's my opinion that the, and obviously on a survey we did a lot of other people's opinion as well, is that, you know, the erosion and the filling up of the lake is actually at the root of most of these problems. And at least that's the way I'm looking at the root of the problems is not necessarily 5 inches in the lake. You know, the experiment was with damming up the lake. It had been thousands of years without that dam. But the silting in of the lake, I think, is going to come back to kill you guys. You know, you'd be looking at getting golf clubs rather than a boat because it's filling in very quickly.
Well, how many thousand years has it been lake?
The lake was formed approximately 15,000 years ago, and the lake has been impounded for about 12. So he's mentioning the experiment has been since 98.
With the fact that it's silting up, ways to deal with silt. But removing dams, when we've had one, when people plan on the dam, is problematic.
Thanks for your comments.
Thanks for your time.
Okay. Save our shoreline, Seth.
I just have one quick update. You know, we're doing that Save Our Shoreline video. I think we have everything shot. The audio is there. That's been put in order. We just need to get some B-roll, just, you know, like shots of the lake and things like that. And Cody then is going to be doing the editing on that video. The other thing then is on maintenance, and that's maintenance of the rain gardens we're talking about. Last month, missed you guys at the meeting. I was thinking about you the whole time I wasn't here. But you guys approved $1,500 for maintenance of the two rain gardens. And after meeting with Doug Spiro, going out and visiting those rain gardens, he gave us a quote of $1,600 for both sites. So he basically, to do maintenance on those sites, he's expecting to be $800 at both. And then, which comes in a little bit higher than what we had budgeted, or not what we budgeted $3,000 for maintenance of those sites. But I think after getting that, him saying it's going to be $1,600 to do both, and we should be able to get most of the plants through NORP, like through that agreement that we have, but there might be a possibility that we're going to have to buy some like mid-range plants to go in there.
Plants are not in the $1,600, right?
No, my understanding is they are not. And I've asked him to break that down more to get, you know, it's like labor and maintenance and the pruning part of it. And I haven't gotten a response from him yet. But I expect it won't be quite $2,200, but I'm basically just updating my request to $2,200 to make sure that we have enough to do the maintenance and then the replanting of those two rain gardens.
Have we been affected adversely by the dryness? Have we lost some plants because of that?
We lost most of them. At Regatta Grounds, we lost quite a bit there. And that was kind of for two reasons. One of them was dryness, but I think we actually lost most of those the year before. Mostly I think what happened is just the plants that we put there probably should have been a little bit further in the depression. Like we used sedges there that we lost a lot of, and I think it was just poor plant selection. And which is something we kind of expected we'd lose a little bit. We definitely lost more than we thought that we would at that site. And then the other part, I guess it was mostly that. Yeah, just poor plant selection and dryness.
Is the dryness, you mean because of lake level or because of rainfall?
Rainfall. Yeah, this is the upland area. It's like by the flagpole lot at Regatta Grounds. Yeah.
Does the city do any kind of irrigation up in the grassy areas of Regatta?
It's a good question. Randy is nodding his head.
There's run around 6 a.m.
So there's no water available there.
We water it on like a weekly basis, but it's just kind of a time issue for us. And we have like a hose that's there. We have like a few different lines that we're going, so we can give it we can moisten it, but as far as really giving it a good saturation, that's been difficult. We've had some talks with North Lincoln Fire to see if we could get access to, there's a fire hydrant like up the hill, to see if, you know, just a few times a year we could get access to that to really give it a good dousing. And there's a possibility maybe for next year we've had that. We've gotten like a little bit of good response back, but haven't talked to the main person yet.
I just think it would be a good idea if not have a bunch of plants dry up and die. If we're going to keep maintaining it and keep, you know, replenishing those plants, I don't want to do it because they're dying every year. So,
and I think for the most part, again, I think it was just poor plant selection for the area.
I think on that one hillside that comes off there on the other side of the mound, I think we expected more water to come through the mound than does during this drier period. And that happened, like you're saying, the year before. And then on the upslope, where we had some salal planted, that's an upland plant. It's just generally likes a little more shade, too, and can sit out in the open, too, as you know. But the salal did not take root there, too. So that kind of leads to having to replace those originally. You know, the watering issue is short term, and so that's why we do have the means to get water on the ground. And then it's, you know, if you look at the rest of it though, it's flourishing. You know, the main part of it, which is where the water treatment is occurring when the storms are bringing water into the system, that's doing really well. So it's kind of been a hit and miss. So it's not just completely, I got a bug flying in my face, sorry. it's not just that it's been failed. You know, I want to just kind of add that.
Yeah, and the other one thing, too, that we did that planting in April. And generally, fall's a really good time to plant because then it gets water for that nine-month period and really gives those plants like a chance to settle in. So like at East Devil's Lake, that rain garden, we did that in the fall. And those plants seem to have made it through this first summer quite a bit better than the plants that were got to ground, so only had a couple of months of rain and then got dried out. Right.
Is there any motions by any board members? You're asking for $2,200, right?
Right.
Just to increase the amount that we authorized last month to $2,200?
Right.
But the $3,000 we had already
budgeted for.
It's budgeted.
Okay, we're $800 under.
Less than what?
We're $800 under budget.
Right.
So do I have any motions?
Yeah, I'll make the motion to increase the allotment to that program to $2,200.
Second.
Okay. Additional comments or discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Okay. Motion carries unanimously. Vegetation management, Paul.
Okay. First element here, the grass carp. Submitted back to our consultant feedback that we had from board members and myself, and they're using that to craft the final draft for our initial submission. We'd like to, I think, include any letters of support we can garnish in the next month or so. I think would give us ourself an opportunity to get some additional letters of support, to get some letters of support for this application, which, you know, we'll basically hold this at least a month before he would submit that. I think that makes sense. We've got kind of that in the works right now. And then once that occurs, once he does submit that, I've kind of outlined what the process looks moving forward. So this is still initial process, but it's kind of a fundamental point. Well, just like any point in the chain is fundamental. But so this submittal goes to the Wildlife Integrity Review Board, who see our application and determine if it meets. Let me just get the wording here to see if the project that does, if it doesn't violate any principles of wildlife integrity, and that's a pretty vague thing. So if it doesn't violate principles of wildlife integrity, or if it doesn't violate them maybe at some level that's beyond reason, you know, maybe there's a margin of error. Like I said, it's a vague statement, and how they interpret it is up to them. Then it can move forward from that point. And if it does, if it doesn't violate those wildlife integrity principles, then they would send it back to Fish and Wildlife in Salem for staff and management review, and probably Newport as well, because that's where the field office is. They would offer comments and ask questions for us to address prior to us submitting this to the commission, is who is basically Fish and Wildlife's boss. It's basically an elected or appointed board of the commission is an appointed board, kind of similar to the governing body here. Well, of course, you're elected, but I think you know what I'm saying. And then our contractor would make that presentation and respond to any questions and answers that they would have, at which time the commission could decide to approve it or table it or deny it. You know, they could make those decisions at that time. If they did approve it, then we would also have to receive the NOAA Fisheries approval as well as the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service approval. So those are federal agencies that oversee Devil's Lake and just any water bodies, you know. Which, if ODFNW gives their approval, there's a greater likelihood of U.S. Fish and Wildlife and NOAA Fisheries giving their approval. No guarantee. They're completely different groups. They have their different interests. And requirements. So, but that's the steps that we have in line for just that grass carp application. I kind of just wanted to make that kind of clear again. So we had a timeline that the contractor submitted. I think it was back in July or something. He gave us a revised timeline. Basically, I think, you know, he had anticipated being at this wildlife integrity viewpoint now, or like by September or something, earlier now than it would have been, because, and that's really because of our review and time frame. You know, if he would have submitted it without that review, well, it wouldn't, I don't think, been in as good a product. And so I think it's great that we did do a review. But basically, as a result, the timeline has shifted. And so he would just, I asked him if he could submit another timeline, and he's just like, well, we just have to factor in any internal reviews that you want to continually conduct. And so, but basically, I don't see that there is any other additional input to the actual submission beyond if we have some letters of support or findings from our recent survey. And those are the things we would do in the next month to get to him.
Okay.
And so then he would submit soon after.
So we're looking at not doing the commission. We're probably looking at second quarter for the commission.
Yes. Well, and it depends on the time it takes for the Wildlife Integrity Board to rule on this, and how much time ODF&W staff then take to review it, because they're going to want to have their staff reports ready for the commission. Just, it's not just us providing information. They're going to have information for their commission to look at, too. So, yes, second quarter, I think, is a pretty fair guess. These things, we know that the commission moves at about a 90-day pace. You've got to get on their agenda, and it's about a three-month window to get on their agenda. So, when staff is ready, provided we get we move past this Wildlife Integrity Review Board, and then at that next point, if staff's ready, then we would say, please put us on the agenda for your next available time.
Is there any recourse if we don't pass muster with this Wildlife Integrity Review Board? Is there any way we can plead our case? Say, well, please understand, et cetera. Try and.
I did not hear that there was an additional window, but I can't guarantee that that was.
I ask this because I remember 8 years after we put the fish in the first time, the carp, we had to go back to Portland and ask for additional carp. Mm-hmm. And that there was a scientist that worked for the Fish and Game who hadn't been there before, but was quite adamant in saying that if he had been there, there would have been no program, because you never bring in species that are not common to the area, etc. And I'm thinking that could be something that fits in into the wildlife integrity realm. If you get somebody like him on there, it's pretty mm-hmm. tough to fight them,
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and wildlife, violate principles of wildlife integrity. That's pretty vague, but it does kind of lend to those types of decisions too. Like, don't introduce species. I mean, that might be one principle. It's a fair guess.
I will say that what I have seen of the parameters for their review of the Wildlife Integrity Review Board is it's really general, and most of it's just not germane at all to what we're trying to do. So, I mean, unless there's more to it than what I've seen, it doesn't seem like it's a big problem. Unless there's some personality on that board that really wants to make it a problem, but.
So the next section on this, unless there's other questions from the grass.
Go ahead.
Okay. Aquatic plant survey. So we've had the second phase of that survey. It was completed between the days of September 17th and 19th, and they should have a full report for us in November, and I'm anticipating that it'll be ready early, like end of October too. So depending on if and when we have our November meeting, we should have that at least available for you. Then you have the economic impact study that we're going to have Seth work on for a December deliverable, and then the engineering study, I honestly just have had not time to move that forward, but there's just a couple things that I'm looking to do in order to see if we cannot have to do an extensive survey by using existing data, GIS data, LIDAR data that's been recently surveyed, and just to have that be equivalent. If it isn't going to work, then we're just going to have an engineer say, yeah, this is where the lake is, and this is the inputs, and this is the outputs. And, you know, that's going to cost some money, but it's not a really difficult thing, given the fact that there's LIDAR data, which is that laser imaging data from an airplane. It really tells you where the ground is. So, and, you know, there's high-quality stream data for Devil's Lake and the whole state of Oregon. So that is a smaller thing, but just letting you know that I don't have any additional changes from last month.
Okay. Anything additional? Paul? Okay, vegetation management? Or is that right? No, communication report.
Well, I don't know if, Brian, did you have any update on sewering or anything else in the...
Oh, I guess I have sewering. Yeah, just to say that, I'm sorry I didn't provide a written report, but there's not much to say other than the city is waiting for a final draft from the engineer, and that and scheduling issues have delayed the consideration by the city council a little bit, but now we've set the dates for, I think it's December 10th and January 8th, or December 10th or December 8th and January 10th, something like that. It'd be the Monday meeting in December and first Monday meeting in December, first Monday meeting in January. First Monday meeting in December would be the consideration by the city council to approve the project, and the January meeting would be the public hearing on approval of the LID for sewer and paving in the LID area.
So now your communications report, kind of similar as from last year, starting off, we have a slot there on KBCH AM 1400, third Tuesday from 7:30 to 8, and they do podcasts regularly of that program. The Oregon Lake Association meeting was held at Crater Lake this year, Friday through Sunday in September there. I gave a short presentation on lake management activities currently happening on Devil's Lake. This included the Devil's Lake Plan, grass carp, septic tank revitalization, SOS, along with details of the water quality monitoring program, particularly the HABS program. There were about 40 to 50 people attending that event. It's pretty good turnout. I mean, 45 to 65 is about typical in a year. Online listserv, so we created that survey that I think is part of the, yes, down below six. But we created a survey using our online listserv, and we got 71 responses back. No, that was, that's an old number. That was the senior fair. We got 120 or so, I think. Yeah, people to fill out that survey. And then we got an additional 71 when we attended the senior fair. And then we got one actually from our newspaper. We got in the mail. So somebody actually cut it out and read it and submitted it just on paper, too.
By the way, I think you would have gotten more responses, but I heard from two people, and no, there's a third. That was me. I tried to answer that survey, and it told me that I had already done it. Same thing with them. Mm. But I already completed it.
Mm.
So I don't know what the problem was. Maybe.
Yeah, I don't know if, like, if you open it and then go back to look at it, and, you know, like you open it right way and think, oh, I should go take the survey, and then it.
But you might have gotten a huge response.
Yeah, but I'm sure we did miss a few, and I'm glad that you pointed that out. We did ensure that we didn't get a lot of duplicates from previous polls that we had tried to submit. We got like 15,000 submittals on a question one time, and it was like there aren't 15,000 people paying that much attention. I mean, it was kind of silly. I mean, that's my personal interpretation of what happened. So obviously there was duplicates, and so what we did set on that survey is that you couldn't do a duplicate from, say, a same computer. Like if you happen to the same IP address, we'd kind of rule that out. So whereas obviously we have missed a few voices potentially, at least from the online. Of course, you could have done it on paper or other means. There's some benefit to that too, that we had kind of more consistent, individual voices, not an echoed a voice from sure. Just somebody typing in the same thing over and over. But thank you. I'm glad to get that feedback. And then so that kind of covers the survey. We had a half page ad in the October 3rd issue of the News Guard that basically showed the survey and this similar thing. It was what was online. We did convert that survey to paper, as I mentioned, and held it, took it to the senior fair event, which was at Chinookwins on October 2nd. And they had a big crowd, biggest crowd they had since. A good 1,250 people at least came through the door, and that's an underestimate because, they give out flu shots. There's a lot of people that go through that door. I think the most significant, it was certainly significant in numbers, is we actually asked Alyssa to hand out surveys to all of the booth people at the booths, because those are our local people. Those are people that are manning the Kiwanis booth, and, the Driftwood Library had a booth, I think, or, whoever else, the AARP and whoever else had booths there. And then she went and collected them, and it was very assertive, and I applaud her for her efforts in that, because I think making eye contact, she said, made eye contact, went out and said, here, please fill this out, and I'll be back, and she did. She followed up on that, and we got at least 30 or so of the 71 were those that constituents. So that was really positive, I think. So thank you, Alyssa, for that. And then, there's some key things about that online survey versus the paper survey. One thing that I noticed right away is that a lot of people don't have email, and it's a senior fair, and it's an aging population. So that may be an important thing to consider as you move forward with making sure you're getting feedback from audiences that are using multiple means of communication. Now, I'm not going to say that seniors don't use email, because I know that a lot of seniors are like, I'm on email, I want to use that, and it's the kids that don't want to use it because they have to deal with it all day long. Kind of like, done with this electronic world. Give me a book to read. There's some reversal there, but it's just important comment to provide. That's basically it. We'll actually, I can combine those. We put the paper ones into electronic form, or Alyssa did, and sent those to you. And Noel, I know you said that the software issue will resolve and get. We'll bring that out at our goal setting meeting in full. And if I can get something fresh to you tomorrow, I will too. So, did everyone else see that by chance? And were able to open that, just so I know.
Yes.
Randy, okay, great. That's that.
Okay, so looks like there was no accidents, so the safety report's pretty quick. How about the TVML?
Okay, so I added a little bit of additional information because I felt like we were going to have a fairly short meeting, and right now we're still at an hour 45, so that was good. But I just kind of wanted to add a little bit of background as to what this technical working group for bacteria is doing, and some of the information that we're seeing. And reviewing, and then DEQ, takes our input and moves forward. And they provided one matrix there, table one there on page 8 of your staff report, which shows where sources are coming from during different times of the year. And so I think a very informing table. Potential sources saying, in this list, and this is why they're getting our feedback, and they want to make sure that the list is complete or, valid for our watersheds. But point sources say a sewer system. That would be a point source. Wading animals, on-site systems, riparian areas, stormwater from impervious land, stormwater from pervious land, and then combined sewer overflows. So in high flow events, if you've got a really high flow, November for our area, it's raining like crazy. and you still get a lot of bacteria, well, you've got a real source happening there. I mean, it's a major source because it's out competing the amount of rainfall. Well, the rainfall can pick up the sources off the land, and that's what your stormwater from pervious land is talking about. Or if you had a sewer that was combined with that and it was flowing into your lake or river or stream, it would show that too. So that would be that's kind of how you read these tables. And then at the and so I highlighted the on-site systems because that's one that we've been concerned with. And then so in a typical flow, and typical flow would be maybe kind of mid-spring, kind of maybe late fall, when you have rain and the water's moving in and out of the system. It's kind of it's not high and dry, and it's not a big rushing system. You know, it's that kind of typical flow. On-site systems can be, you know, can be a contributor or can be one that you might want to focus on. Whereas if it's a high flow, like I said, you want to look at something else. But where it really starts to become noticeable is during the dry flow periods. And dry flow is different than low flow. You'd think that dry flow was the least amount of water. Dry flow is basically July. Okay, it's sunny, it's not raining, it's dry. Low flow is like right now, where it's been sunny, it's been dry, and it's like at its lowest flow. So if you look at Thompson Creek right now, it's trickling. Niatsu Creek, we heard, is trickling. Rock Creek's still flowing, for sure. But they're flowing at their lowest, more or less, you know, based on a one-year cycle. And so in a dry flow, say July, August, maybe September, septic systems would show up more readily. If you get to a really dry, you know, and you get to low flow, then they might not show up at all because the water table is so low that it's not picking it up anymore. So it's kind of the septic system just percolating right and evaporating maybe right on the property. So it can kind of, you know, hide the potential impact because it's actually the ground's so dry. So that's kind of how you read this, and I just wanted to kind of walk you through a little bit of that just to show it. And then they have this what's called this low duration curve, which is the second figure on that, and it's a pretty small print there, but I can describe what you're seeing. Is you're seeing a line that is depicting this maximum criteria for bacteria, which is 406 per milliliter, or per 100 milliliters, excuse me. And so that line is shown in a logarithmic scale, and then they have spots. This is just an example of real data and how you might look at it. Like, oh, okay, so the violations are happening in this example only in dry flow and low flow predominantly. There's one kind of more transitional. So then you would say, okay, so in that system, you've got violations that are happening probably late summer or something, or midsummer. And so you'd go back up to your table and say, well, what are the more likely candidates for that violation? Maybe a waiting animal, you know. And then if, you know, so let's look at fencing, or let's look at some property management kind of things. Let's look at on-site systems. And that's how this process seeks to resolve the issues of bacteria.
So the model then suggests that you're, with the water flow and where the water is being drawn from, actually provides indications to the point source of the E. coli or whatever. So like if it's coming off if it's coming off the surface, mm-hmm. during a rainy period, mm-hmm. versus when you're drawing down and you're pulling from the groundwater, mm-hmm. and the water table itself, mm-hmm. before you get to a point where where you know you're getting down into your extreme levels of groundwater that are very deep or whatever. How does that change from region to region or within the watershed in terms of, you know, like if you were to correlate like Niatsu Creek, Thompson Creek, and Rock Creek and say, do they all follow the same model at the same time of the year, or do they have differentials based on the topography upstream? Or
yes and yes. You know, I think that by and large they do follow similar patterns, as because they're what's driving this is the amount of rainfall in your geographic region. Because they're so geographically close, they're going to exhibit similar activity. You know, if you have a really steep system and you've got like maybe a really shallow bedrock system where every drop of rain hits bedrock more or less, maybe it goes through some trees, but this is going to hit that bedrock and go down the stream, well, then that's going to move everything very quickly down to the lake, if you will, if that's your endpoint. And so that system that had bedrock and was quick to move water would act differently than a system that had more permeable soils and, you know, water percolated slowly through it, and the water table would kind of hold water longer and then discharge, you know, all the way through September and October, versus the very fast moving systems would dry up, say, you know, June 30th or something, whenever it stopped raining. So more or less they're going to act more the same, but you could have some variation.
Thanks.
Got for that.
Any other questions for the TDML portion? Hey, Alyssa.
Okay. All right. So I've continued weeding and watering weekly. These devils like State Park and Regatta Grounds. We've made a good amount of progress and are planning on replanting the rain gardens later this month. I finished creating a digital archive of all of the audits and the majority of the budgets, and which the next step is just putting them online so that they're available to the public. We did our first round of DNA analysis, and I've read the fecal source tracking, sampling, and analysis plan and learned how to carry out the laboratory techniques. I also made a series of demonstration videos meant to teach future interns how to do the process. I worked at the Chinook Winds Casino Senior Fair, and promoted the recent survey put out by our district. We were able to get 72 responses from the senior fair alone, and I'll be putting the results online for people. We've already sent them to you. In addition, I've got on KBCH Radio with Seth, running the district and informing the public what we are doing now that the water quality monitoring program is over. I've been promoting the upcoming erosion seminar by distributing flyers and encouraging people to attend.
And worked very hard.
Sounds like you did a lot. This is your last month, is it not?
My internship ends on November 13th, so I will be able to make the next meeting.
If we have one, sure. Okay. Or when, depending upon when we have it. Okay. Thanks. Any questions? Okay, East Devils Lake Road. I guess okay. That's just a placeholder.
Yeah, I did. There is a little clarification as to where the process is, though. They are, the Salmon Drift Creek Watershed Council is waiting for, I guess it's a final report from the county, which then they would submit to stakeholders to really open up this process. And so that's, it's a little bit further than it was last year, or last month. I want to just relay that. But, yeah, it's still a placeholder for when that process really gets rolling.
Okay. And lake level monitoring.
Yeah, so we actually finished our doc survey this week. So we got that in time with the weather that's going to potentially occur here this weekend. So that was good. And then so we'll be compiling that information and bringing it back to you potentially November, December. I don't know what that'll look like, but I think November. And then that we're also going to bring back information relative to the other components that went into your decision-making process. We talked about salmon, we talked about septics, and we talked about vegetation, and we talked about water quality and recreation. So this is where we are in that.
Okay. Thanks. Any questions for Paul? I don't think we have any new business. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's about the first time since I started. I think we had one other day that we didn't have new business. So I was kind of happy to have. Which we have our goal setting coming up, so that's good. So there's opportunity. There's your window.
Not agenda items? I don't think we have any.
I have a question. That is, what is the effect, or have you established, I think it's the effect of rain occurrence. There's algae in the lake. In other words, if we get a good solid day of rain, say we had or something like that, midst of a trachea, would it have the course of it, do you think, or not?
It definitely can, because rain is often cooling. I mean, that's what it's going to mostly do, is it's going to cool the lake, and, you know, and it's going to, you know, the Glowotrichia are floating to the top, too, so rain is going to be hitting their heads, effectively, so it's going to, you know, be a bit of a setback. Now, does it change the water temperature enough, or do you have, cloudy conditions that is, you know, really take away their photosynthesis, because that's, you know, really what's happening. You know, if you had just had a bit of rain and then it was sunny again, you know, even though it was three inches, it might not change that equation at all. And then the other potential real impact of rain is the reverse too. You know, rain brings in nutrients, and so nutrients feed cyanobacteria, blue-green algae. So if you had a pulse of newly kind of distributed nutrients as a result of stormwater systems that were bringing it in, or, you know, somebody just had fertilized their lawn and all of a sudden it rains, that's going to come down into the lake too. So yes, it can knock it down. It can cool the system, which is a direct, often link. You know, when the water temperature does drop down, it does tend to change the system. Just like when it, you know, like we said, it does warm up. We do see that. But nutrients, again, the sunlight, you know, is just huge. I mean, it's. So
thanks.
Any other non-agenda items? Okay. Any additional public comment? So, board announcements and comments. You know, I think we talked about last month doing something different in our November meeting. We have a conflict with the current schedule and participation at the NOMS conference. So we have the option of, you know, moving forward to basically, I think, November 1st or the 15th. Either one, kind of, we're either moving in really against what we're doing now, to not have much information come in, or we're moving close enough to December that, you know, like with the holidays and all that are going on, that we probably wouldn't have, you know, a whole lot, you know, difference between the two. I think, personally, I think, you know, with the amount of new businesses going on being not very much, if the other directors don't feel it's necessary, I would, you know, personally suggest that, you know, potentially we, you know, go ahead and authorize Paul to pay the bills for the month of November and, you know, extend our meeting in December to have a little bit more time as needed.
I have no problem.
I don't have
with
a
that.
Problem with that. I can't, I couldn't make a meeting if we set it for November 1st. So if we did have a November meeting and it was on a Thursday, it'd have to be November 15th, which. That's the December date, so I don't have a problem with that.
Okay, so I guess I'll make a motion that we do not have a regular meeting in November, and that we authorize Paul to do the transfers necessary to keep the operations of the district going until our December meeting.
I so move.
So you're seconding? Okay. Any additional comment? All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, motion carries unanimously. Okay, announcement. We are going to be here on Saturday morning at 10 a.m. to do a goal-setting session, to run through the Devil's Lake plan, look at the survey responses, and set, you know, our next set of goals and make sure that we're on track with our current activities for the coming, you know, year or so. So that will be here in the City Council chambers at 10 a.m. on Saturday morning. And then we have the Erosion Control and Sediment, or Erosion Prevention and Sediment Control Summit on October 25th, 8 a.m. to 1 p.m., and that's here as well.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct? In
yep.
The City Council chambers.
It's a free event, and it's open to, you know, basically anybody, but it's aimed at contractors, developers, people that are moving soil, you know, excavators, that kind of thing. I mean, that's the target audience, so we definitely encourage them. I know the city sent out an invite to their list like this week or something, and we've got some posters up around town that Seth distributed, and you know, put out a little email alert as well. But yeah, please come. It's a free event. We've got a few door prizes that vendors are bringing too, so there's a little incentive. Get a $50 gift card or something. I think one of the vendors is providing. I know North Lincoln Sanitary's got a sweatshirt or something. So it's again, it's 8 to 1, and it's going to be here at this City Hall here, Lincoln City Hall, Council Chambers.
Thanks, Paul. Any additional announcements from board members?
Yeah, I got one or two.
Or comments?
On November 16th is the, this is probably inappropriate, but I'll go ahead and do it anyway, is the Beach Bark auction at the Eventuary. And for those of you that don't know, that Lincoln City is unique in that if you're a person without means and you have a pet or animal that gets ill, you can take them to either vet in town, and we go ahead and pay that bill for you. We went through $18,000 worth of vet care for pets in need, and so we're encouraging the public to bring anything that they would like us to auction over to the anchor, and we'll make sure it gets there. So far, I think we're making good progress. I think I've got like $17,954 more to go. And and then the second thing is normally at the anchor we have a Halloween party, and last year we had somewhere around 1,500 to 1,600 participants in that, and we've formally outgrown the anchor, so we're working together with the school district, and the Halloween party or the Halloween event will happen at the Taft Elementary School, and it'll be from 5 until 9, and everything that was at the anchor with fortune tellers and trick-or-treating and cakewalks and everything else will all be there, and except now we'll have lots of parking and a lot more room. So hope to see everyone there. That's it.
Thank you.
Primarily it's for children. It's not scary at all, and there's no charge for admission. And there's lots of prizes and stuff to eat and plenty of trick-or-treats. And we really reach out to the community. It's an old-fashioned Halloween. Well, some of us that were alive in the 50s remember how cool Halloween used to be. So it's a Halloween treat from the 50s. So
okay.
Actually had a wholesomeness about it.
Fantastic. Thanks, Kip. Yep. Any additional comments?
I do have a comment on the public comment on the lake level discussion. First of all, we're doing the monitoring and the survey, and so I think the information that Mitchell Moore has brought forward and that Mr. Dooling has brought to us is more information that we should incorporate into that, the monitoring and the surveying and it all into consideration and evaluate it. It might be helpful, it might not, but it needs to be evaluated and it should be included in our surveying. There was a letter read that for the second or third time is directed at comments that I've made in previous meetings about the accuracy of those comments, and apparently saying that in the last meeting I was attacking a statement that wasn't actually made. And I'm just saying, people, if you're interested in any of that, go back and read the minutes of the previous meetings. They're accurate.
The audio is also available.
Linda does a wonderful job of reporting what was said, and all you've got to do is read that, and you don't have to listen to it through the filter of interpretation. The other thing is, it needs to be understood that we don't just represent the interests of lakefront property owners. That, or at least, I know I speak for all of you when I say that. We represent. I mean, the district is bigger than the city of Lincoln City. It's the city of Lincoln City and that part of the watershed of Devil's Lake that's outside the city. So, you know, when we take the interests of the lake into consideration, it's not just the interests of lakefront property owners. And so, and I have had similar experience to Kip, informed people who come up to me and understand what the factors that go into our decision, you know, say they appreciate the consideration that were given to this. And also that even lakefront property owners came up to me after we made the decision to only impound up to a level of 9 feet this summer, that they thought that was a good decision based on the information that we had at that point. And what we're doing now is continuing to get more information and evaluate that information. And Mitchell Moore alluded to, we'll just have that much more information to make a decision again next May. So,
and I'd like to join in on that subject. I sell fuel on the lake, and so I get a lot of boaters. And I have to say that got no positive comments from anybody about the depth of the lake. I got only adverse comments because they had boats, and some of them were having problems getting their boats on and off their lifts. I don't know what the reason for that is, whether it's their lifts or the way they put them in, or it's the shallowness of the lake. But and I personally would like to see us opt for a higher level. On the other hand, I have a point at right now, because of the type of year we had, no rainfall. I don't know what would have happened in a normal year. Perhaps we wouldn't have had this problem, even though we had kept it at 9. Maybe it would have stayed closer to 9 for a longer period of time if we'd had normal rainfall. Since we didn't, I can't really say, you see what happened? Now we've got to go up. I can't do it.
So I will adjourn the meeting.